Hello and welcome to another episode of the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
The podcast that brings you the chronological history of the Second World War seen through the silver screen. Now, as promised, for quite some time now, because we keep getting distracted by more and more films, we are where, Simon?
Well, we're at the Eastern Front. We're at Operation Barbarossa. Woo-hoo! We've finally made it. And
it did take about a year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've been quite thorough. And we've managed to miss out some gargantuan parts of World War II already, such as the occupation of France, which we seem to have completely dismissed. So we do apologise to our French brethren there.
There aren't many films about just the occupation, honest.
You're right. The
French didn't seem too keen on making films about being under the Nazi jackboot.
I did come across one, but it was... We'd lapped it already, you see. We couldn't really go back on ourselves. And that's the movie with Jean Reno. Then the name of it, I can't remember at all.
The movie with Jean Reno.
Yes.
So here we are, Simon. It is June 1941. We're on the Eastern Front. Now, I think what we're going to do, because this is one of our favourite films.
Absolutely.
Fortress of War.
A.K.A. the Brest Fortress.
A.K.A. Fortress? Was it also Fortress somewhere?
Yeah, quite possibly.
Anyway, I'm going to do my usual little bit of history, except it may be a little bit more than a little bit of history, because there's rather a lot to go over before we even get to Brest. But shall I just have at it, Simon?
Absolutely.
All right, so those of you who have been following along and making notes may remember that way back when, the Germans and the Soviets made a convenient little pact called the, Simon?
The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Which was basically a secret agreement that they wouldn't attack each other and that they would divide up the spoils of Eastern Central Europe between them, which basically meant that Poland got cut in half, and Russia could basically sort of help itself. In terms of actual fighting, the only bit of sort of Second World War fighting that the Soviets had engaged in up to this point was the Winter War, which we covered.
Yeah, against Finland.
Yeah, which we covered in a really quite good film. We quite enjoyed that one, didn't we?
Well,
the Winter War.
Well, no. If you remember correctly, so the movie April 9th we liked an awful lot, which was a Danish film.
Yeah.
But no, the
we didn't like Winter War.
No, it's diabolical.
didn't some fella get blown up while he was going to the toilet?
That bit was brilliant. But
wasn't it?
The film was a real mess, but we decided that whilst looking at it, it's just, well, hold on. The only copy we could get hold of was a 2-hour version, and the original version is closer to 4 hours.
That's right. It had been chopped
to bits.
It made no sense.
Yeah, it was a real dog's dinner of the film.
Main characters just disappeared because obviously they died in the edit and just
They were there lying on the cutting room floor pleading for mercy.
But the what you take away from the Winter War, Simon, is that the Soviets weren't really very good at the whole warfare thing.
Absolutely.
And there are some very, very specific reasons for that. One of them being that Comrade Stalin was a complete psychopath. And a combination of his psychopathy, paranoia and megalomania meant that he had executed or imprisoned most of the Red Army general staff.
Well, I mean, and not only that, so this is Stalin's purge. Not only that, of course, the person responsible for starting the Red Army and making it something, some kind of military, formidable military, was Trotsky, who, of course, he loathed and exiled.
Yeah. So that wasn't off to a great start. It really was those... I can't even begin to imagine what those pre-war years in the Soviet Union were like. It must have been terrifying because people were arrested, executed, imprisoned on the most whimsical of reasons.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Stalin didn't like the colour of their hair or,
well,
you know.
That's it.
I mean, it was that kind of mental.
If anyone thought that the Soviet Union and the Bolsheviks were not a dictatorship prior to Stalin, they certainly did then.
Yeah. I would encourage people who are interested in this to read the brilliant Stalingrad book by Anthony Beaver, which sort of covers the whole beginning of Operation Barbarossa, but its main focus is on the siege of Stalingrad, which we will come to in a whole bunch of movies just round the corner.
Of course. And also recommend the Osprey three-part books on Operation Barbarossa and Jonathan Dimbleby's Barbarossa.
Yeah. All excellent resources for what we're talking about here. But Anthony Beaver, at the beginning of his book, Stalingrad, points out that it sort of boggles the mind. It's really hard in today's world. I mean, even Putin isn't quite this insane, although he's obviously would love to be Stalin. He's just literally not that nuts. But during the Stalin purges, 36,671 officers were executed, imprisoned, or dismissed. And out of the 706 officers of the rank of brigade commander or above, only 303 remained. As an example of how insane some of this was, the went on to be a great hero of the Second World War, Colonel Rokossovsky, he, at the outbreak of Operation Barbarossa, he was languishing in prison, refusing to say a bad word about Comrade Stalin, despite the fact that he had been arrested, tried, and imprisoned on the evidence provided by a man who'd been dead for 20 years.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, he was just making it up. Him and Beria together were, for those who don't know, Beria was basically, he was the head of the NKVD and the security forces and also a complete nutter.
Well, a rapist, and later, they found out once they started pulling his floorboards away, he was also a serial killer.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about some deeply, deeply deranged human beings. So all the sensible human beings in the Soviet Union had sort of perished or hidden or been arrested and imprisoned. So this is the sort of state of the Soviet army. They had had this really quite embarrassing and humiliating defeat at the hands of Finland in the Winter War, although they did eventually prevail purely by the Soviet tactic of just throwing as many men as they could at it until it was won.
I think the best way to describe the Winter War is a humiliating victory. Does that make sense?
Now, meanwhile, back in Berlin, Hitler was basically looking at this and licking his lips. And they realised, the Wehrmacht, that Russia really wasn't up to all that much. And the Winter War defeat really proved that the Russian army really wasn't capable of anything. As Hitler said himself, if you kick in the door, the whole rotten structure will come crashing down. That was his summation of the Soviet Union. So as early as 1940, the summer of 1940, despite the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Hitler had and his generals had already started planning for an invasion of the Soviet Union. Now, invading Russia has never really been very successful for anyone. Napoleon gloriously and magnificently completely failed, and his entire army was destroyed in its horrible and horrifying retreat from Moscow in the middle of Arctic winter. And quite a few German generals were very sceptical about this plan of Hitler's to invade at all. In fact, one general who had been given the task of of calculating the financial cost had come up with a very honest calculation that Germany couldn't afford it. And Hitler's sort of yes men around him said, no, 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 that's no good. Go away, come back with something that does work. So he came back and just said, yeah, it'll work.
Amazing.
So we sort of, this is the amazing thing also, when we're starting to get into Operation Barbarossa and the Soviet-German war, it really does boil down, Simon, to two nutters basically trying to...
Out-nut each other.
And we were talking about this, weren't we, while watching the film, Simon? Mm. This wasn't so much a military combat between two massive armies. It was literally a war of ideology. So the Nazis hated the Bolsheviks. They despised them. And they despised the Ukrainians and the Soviets in general. And Hitler's plan for Operation Barbarossa was nothing short of an entire annihilation.
Of the Slavs. Yeah.
All of them were going to die. And his biggest idea was he wanted to create this Lebensraum that you hear all the time being spoken about in history with regards to Third Reich. And Lebensraum literally translated means living space. And he wanted his great Aryan nation to have this boundless, wonderful garden to live in. And he looked at the sort of the breadbasket of Ukraine and the massive oil fields
of Siberia
and the Caucasus, and he basically said, yeah, that'll do us, we'll have some of that, which led to June 22nd 1941. Now here's the other mad thing, is despite reports coming back from the Soviet border that literally millions of men and tanks and aircraft were all lining up, Stalin wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems was as well as yes, he wouldn't believe it, but also one of the heads of the army at that point, Pavlov, wouldn't believe it also, and even though another chief of the army who went on to become a legend, Kutuzov, kept saying to Pavlov, this is going to happen, they're about to go they're on our doorstep. I mean, again, this is all sounding very, very familiar.
Yeah.
And Pavlov, who was at the theater the night of, I think it was the 21st, so just prior to the invasion, was at the theatre, and someone, after Kutuzov had informed him, had come to tell him that this is going to happen, and he was like, no, it's not, and he stayed for the second act. I mean, that's priceless.
And I think there was also, listen, we've mentioned about how psychotic Stalin was. Imagine if it was your job to go into Comrade Stalin's office and say, the Germans are going to invade us.
Well, I mean, this is where...
You're 50-50, you may be shot on the spot being defeatist.
This is where Hitler and Stalin are so similar, right? I mean, people are terrified of telling them the truth, because if the truth makes them or their army look weak, that's the firing squad. And then, of course, if you don't tell him the truth, that's the firing squad. I mean, there really is no place to go. It's a proper catch-22. Yep. I mean, there are so many accounts through Operation Barbarossa of people not wanting to wake Stalin up because they were too scared.
Which, by the way, you cut to 3 years later, and famously... on the D-Day landings, they didn't want to wake up Hitler because he'd taken a sleeping pill and given direct orders not to be disturbed.
But what kind of a leader of a war-torn nation and also an invading nation decides to take a sleeping pill and says, please do not disturb? I mean, anything could be happening at that point. It's just like, no, I don't want to know about it. It's just like, are you sure, Adolf?
But this is the megalomania of these men, is that they were so utterly convinced not only of them being the most right person in the room, but also their infallibility. It's almost like Stalin had believed his own propaganda from the last 20 years, which was that the Soviet Union was this undefeatable, magnificent machine of...
Absolutely.
Of workers and soldiers who would live and die for the state.
Yeah, and just...
no matter what.
And galvanised to defeat any enemy that would dare, you know, touch their sacred land, which, again, sounds very, very familiar.
Yeah. You're going to see, for those of you who have been paying any attention to what's going on in Ukraine since February 24th of last year, you're going to see some really shockingly obvious parallels here. The sort of which...
Just on the other side.
Yeah, like, but reversed.
Yeah.
Exactly. What this is what's bonkers is for all of Vladimir Putin sort of idolizing Stalin, he obviously hasn't actually read any history books because he would have known what happened to the Germans when they invaded Ukraine Soviet Union.
Well, when they invaded Belarus.
Yeah,
and it's quite unreal, and you're quite. I mean, I thoroughly agree with your point of believing their own propaganda, because that's exactly what I think Putin's done as well, and
surrounded by people who are terrified to tell him the truth.
Exactly, surrounded by yes men. Well, I mean, prior to all this, we were sitting down and we've been watching. I mean, both of us are very interested in geopolitics, specifically because of our interest in World War II and the Soviet Union. I mean, especially, I'd say that we were watching this lead up to the Ukraine-Russia war and going like, oh, my God, Ukraine are in such trouble. They are just going to be absolutely thumped. I mean, even we believed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not surprised that his cabinet, I mean, can you imagine the domino rally of yes men in that situation?
Oh, unbelievable.
And how corrupt the military is.
Yeah.
Due to people being so poor and selling off bits of military hardware and fuel and so on and so forth. Mental.
I mean, oddly enough, that's the one thing I think the Red Army didn't suffer from. They just literally had nobody to run anything because they were all either dead or in prison.
Yeah.
So they had all the tanks and planes. They just didn't have anyone to tell the tanks and planes what to do. I mean, for instance, another shocking victim of Stalin's purges was, and probably the most senior ranking officer to end up with the chop was Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who was a leading advocate of mobile warfare, and his theories on tank formations and how to defend with armor and artillery probably would have meant that Germany would never have got off the starting block, but he'd been shot.
God.
So nobody was there to do that. So to move forward quickly, because this is such an enormous subject. I mean, we did debate having it our own little extra episode just on the history.
This is kind of it.
This is it. You're getting a two for one here.
And also, it's important for us to remember that, of course, yes, this is a historical podcast as such, but it's not really. It's a movie podcast.
Yeah, so we're getting to it.
And of course, there are many historical inaccuracies in movies.
Right. So just to highlight a few things, because they are going to come up in the film, so they are sort of important. As part of Hitler's idea of the eradication of everything Slav, he also wanted all the Jews exterminated, as per usual, which led to this it was called the Commissar Order, the Commissar Diktat.
Yeah.
Inside the Soviet Red Army, Simon's probably the best person to tell you about this, but there were several branches of the army and they all sort of interwove, but not in a particularly healthy way. So correct me if I'm wrong, Simon, you had the General Red Army.
Yeah.
You had the border guards, who we're going to see quite a bit of in this film.
Well, yeah, you've got the border guards, absolutely.
Who were also a subsidiary of the NKVD.
The NKVD, so the border guards still exist, okay? And the the differentiation between them and other soldiers is that their striped tops, which is so famous in the Russian, Soviet military, but now Russian military, is that instead of black and white or navy and white is the Marines.
Yeah.
Black and white and the pale blue is the airborne. The green is the border guards. Right. So the green hats, the green striped tops, they're the border guards. They are the FSB. They're still run by the FSB. So back then, KGB, and then where we are now, NKVD.
Yeah. And they were sort of the paramilitary branch of the NKVD.
Yeah.
Who at the very head of which you had Beria.
But Beria would not have been in charge of the border guards.
Exactly.
So he would have been in charge of the NKVD.
And the spying and the surveilling and the general arresting of anybody.
Of which there is a military wing as well. So they are the blue hats.
Right. And you'll see this in the film. Soviet officers had these sort of peak caps that either have a blue or a green or a red band around them. And that basically signifies who and what they are.
Yeah.
And what, yeah. And now, inside of the entire Soviet military, you have, at a regimental, all the way down to company and even platoon level, political commissars.
Yeah.
Now, their job was basically to ensure that everybody was towing the party line, that there was no defeatism, there was no sort of that there was nobody questioning the great Soviet struggle of the working classes against the fascists and the imperialists and the capitalists. That was basically their job. They were the sort of political wing of the army.
Absolutely. So a commissar is not obviously strictly just something which was in the Soviet military. I mean, you had it in China, Vietnam, Germany. I think the first commissars were actually French. But the whole point being, of course, is that, yes, it's about towing the party line. But the main reason, and it was something that Trotsky had instilled in the Red Army, is that you've got to remember they'd already been through two revolutions.
Right.
Now, there could have been a counter-revolution. And where do counter-revolutions and coups normally start? They start in the military. It's when the amount of times we've seen military coups take place throughout the world, it was to stop that happening. It was also to stop any of the whites, the white Russians.
Yep. Who had previously made up the Tsarist military.
Exactly, and of which there would have been so many that would have fought on both sides at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's to stop them regrouping and taking over. So the Bolshevik ideal was rammed down the throat of all troops by the commissar.
And for Stalin, as I said before, as much as Hitler wanted to wipe out Bolshevism, Stalin knew that this wasn't just a battle for land. This was a battle for the survival of the Bolshevik Revolution. And so the stakes were enormous, and thus the planting of political commissars inside of all units of the Soviet military. Now, for those of you who love war movies, a very famous political commissar was in The Hunt for Red October, and Tim Curry is the political commissar.
Tim Curry, that's amazing.
He's brilliant, though. assigned to the Red October submarine, and Sean Connery kills him.
Right.
Because he's got to get rid of him to make sure that the plan to escape works.
Well, also, he has to kill him, doesn't he? Because they have to make Sean Connery's character a kind of American communist,
yeah.
An American loving, you know, a yeah. free world communist.
That's it, exactly.
That's only an American writer like Tom Clancy.
Now, the reason we went down this little rabbit hole here is that there's a character in this film that's very important and is Simon and I's favourite.
Oh, I love him.
A character called Fomin. And now, it's important to remember also that probably 75% of the characters we're going to talk about in this film really did exist. And they exist because they have posthumously, and those that survived, been recognized as heroes of the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
And have and that they, and indeed the fortress itself, which was post-war given the title Hero Fortress.
That's in 1965.
Became symbols of the Soviet struggle and the Soviet resilience to Western imperialist capitalism.
So you were just talking about characters, or you know, characters in this film, most of them being real. There are three key soldiers in this film, all based on real dudes. But I mean,
we'll get to them when we get to the film. And I'm just going to do this the last bit of history, Simon, because we're gagging to get to the film bit because we enjoy it so much. Basically, Operation Barbarossa. Named after Frederick the Great, Frederick Barbarossa, the great military German general. It launched on the 22nd of June 1941 and was as successful as everyone in Germany thought it was going to be. As we get later into the Operation Barbarossa and the siege of Leningrad and then the siege of Stalingrad, we start to see how it unravels. But to begin with, it was a romping success.
Well, it's a romping success so you've got three German army groups.
Yeah.
You've got Army Group North, Army Group South, Army Group Centre.
And they all had different objectives, right, yeah. Simon?
But Army Group Centre came up against this, and this was something which held them back by a good few days. Not what they were expecting at all.
The Brest Fortress we're talking about. And I'm laughing because it held them up for a few days. Within 5 days of the launch of the operation, General von Manstein's Panzer Corps that was romping at 50 miles a day was halfway to Leningrad already.
Yeah.
So the fact that anyone was held up at all is sort of astonishing. However, they did hold them up, and that's what this film is about. But to put this into sort of perspective, because this the sort of numbers are sort of astonishing. The Germans were capturing entire Soviet armies at a go. And when I say entire Soviet armies, we're talking about 300, 500, 700,000 men in Kiev and Minsk. So in the first 3 weeks of fighting, the Red Army had lost 3,500 tanks, over 6,000 aircraft, and some 2 million men. I mean, those are figures that make any other conflict in World War II up to this date seem insignificant.
Well, I think any other conflict, it's just mind-blowing.
And indeed, the entire struggle on the Eastern Front is probably the most horrifying of the Second World War, because just the numbers of involved and the numbers who died is sort of melts your brain. It is just astonishing. And the mere fact that a country could absorb those kind of losses and still prevail just a couple of years later shows you how incredibly drastically this turned around for the Germans and how incredibly quickly it turned around. And in later episodes, when we do Leningrad, when we do Stalingrad, we'll discuss some of those because they have been talked about and argued about by historians for decades.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But that's to put into context. Just the final thing I'm going to say, Simon, before we start, just to show what was facing these 9,000 soldiers in the Brest Fortress when the Operation Barbarossa launched, the Germans, it's also important to remember, it was an Axis army. It wasn't just the Germans. There were Romanians and Hungarians involved as well. But 3.8 million men, basically, had lined up. Mm. Nearly 4,000 tanks, 5,000 aircraft, 23,000 artillery pieces. We're talking about the biggest land invasion in the history of the planet was just waiting to go. And right slap bang in the middle of it in Belarus, there's this 19th century fortress. And that's where we are. That's the film.
And just quickly before we start, because it's not actually mentioned in the film, which is a bit odd, maybe because there is, I mean, it's one of those films where, compared to a lot of other films made 5 to 6 years later, it doesn't have a full-on revisionist history. It does have episodes of it, for sure.
Yeah, and a couple of glaring ones at that.
But compared to some of the films that we will later cover, it's
T-34.
It's much more
realistic.
And accurate. I think it is. Now, at the Brest Fortress, one of the reasons, so I was talked about how Army Group Center was held up, and they're held up due to a quite heroic feat of these dudes at the Brest Fortress.
Yep.
Now, one of the reasons they were held up so massively, well, I mean, I'd say it's the main reason, is that the Germans were expecting one battalion to be at the Brest Fortress, but there was an unexpected amount of troops stationed there. There was another 7,000, so that's why there's 9,000 of them.
Yeah. Which brings us to the opening of our film, Simon. Do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on the Fortress of War?
Absolutely.
Released in 2010. Yeah. Take it away.
Okay, yeah. So Fortress of War, a.k.a. the Brest Fortress, a.k.a. Fortress, is a co-production between Belarus and Russia. So it's obviously about the defence of the Brest Fortress and the opening of Operation Barbarossa. Now, the movie, now this is what I find quite incredible, because when you see the film, you'll see the scale of it, and only now and then, with a couple of dodgy special effects, which always seem to involve planes in these films, it's pretty decent stuff, and it feels like it's got a decent budget.
Oh, it's epic but on its scale.
But the director, Alexander Kott, it's his first film.
Which is amazing.
It is amazing. So, but he's better known, probably. I mean, this is probably his most well-known film outside of Russia, but inside Russia, there's a group of comedy movies called Yolki, right?
And sounds hilarious already.
Well, I bet it isn't. But anyway, he didn't direct the original Yolki. He directed Yolki 2 all the way through to Yolki 6. Now, the only other thing I've seen by him is that he directed the TV series of Trotsky with one of my favourite actors, Konstantin Kabensky.
Ooh.
That's worth a look. It's very over the top in parts. Top heavy on the bullshit, but a rip-roaring series from start to finish and an amazing performance by Kabensky. Anyway, so that's the director. It's got four writers. Never a good sign.
Yeah.
But the main writer is Vladimir Yeromonin. Yeromonin is a Russian theatre actor and writer. Interestingly, he signed a petition against the annexation of Crimea. So where he is right now, I'm not sure, but I hope he's all right.
Probably not.
I don't want to go into it too much. This was released, as we were saying, on 22nd of June, 2010, though, and distributed by a group called Central Partnership. Now, Central Partnership are very interesting, and not for many good reasons.
Oh, dear.
The companies behind it were Mosfilm, but Central Partnership were the distributors. Now, Central Partnership, at that point, I think were an independent company. They are now owned by Gazprom. Okay. Whenever you see something distributed by Central Partnership and it's a war movie, expect much revisionist history.
Yeah. And propaganda.
Yeah, for sure.
They also have one of the worst logos.
It's quite
the beginning of a film.
It's quite incredible. It's like a giant silver orb airship, isn't it?
Oh, my word, yeah.
It's very strange.
And quite militaristic.
Yes. So, anyway, the film, it's narrated by a young... Well, an old man who was in the military band at the Brest Fortress, and his name is Alexander, or Sasha, or Sashka.
Yeah.
His brother is also in the military at the fortress, but they are orphans, and they are orphans just so we know, right, from the get-go, just how great and how red they are.
Yeah.
Their parents are orphans because their parents died fighting in the Spanish Civil War, okay? The first main character we come across, and I did say there were three main characters.
There are.
The first one we come across is Andrei Kijevatov. He is the commander of the border guards, and he's
played by Andrei Mazlikin.
Yeah, so I'll talk. Do you want me to talk about the actor or the character first?
Let's talk about the actor, and then we'll do the characters as we go through the film.
Okay, so Mazlikin. Andrei Ilyich Mazlikin is Russian film and theatre actor. He's from, supposedly, it says from Kaliningrad. But Kaliningrad, to me, means that it's not Russia. It's the part where the Baltic Fleet is stationed between Belarus and Poland.
And he's good.
He's amazing. He's an amazing actor.
We should, to save time, we should just say everyone's brilliant in this.
Yeah, they are. Everyone's very, very strong. But so he's in another... another war movie set in this period, the sequel to Burnt by the Sun, called Burnt by the Sun 2. Burnt by the Sun 2 comes in two parts. You've got Burnt by the Sun 2 Exodus and Burnt by the Sun 2 Citadel. Burnt by the Sun 2 Exodus is set this is obviously in the summer here at the Brest Fortress. This is set about 3 months later when the mush and the mud is starting to kick in.
Yeah,
he's also very good in that, but that film is a crock of. The original, okay. Burnt by the Sun, is brilliant. The sequels are chest-beating propaganda.
Wow, all right.
And anyway, his take is much on Russia's annexation of Crimea and their invasion of the Donbass is very different to the writer's. He championed the invasion of the Donbass, calling it a liberation by Russian heroes, and went out there and performed for the troops. I'm not sure what he performed. I can't imagine it was a part of the Brest Fortress. Because someone probably on the opposing side would have shot him. But, that's his politics anyway.
Oh, dear.
Which is slightly sad.
Then we have our other favourite character, Fomin.
Well, I mean, all three of them are my favourites, but this dude is my favourite. So, Yefim Fomin is a very interesting story. So, he is the commissar of the rifle regiment, and he's Jewish, as you'll probably guess from his name, a Jewish communist commissar, and he is also an orphan and was brought up in orphanages. He lost his parents when he was very, very young, and he was born in Kolishki in the Vitebsk Voblast in the Russian Empire back in 1909. Now, his is the most tragic story because...
Well, don't give anything away yet.
Okay.
We'll get to it because we want to build him up for the great hero that he is.
Okay, fair enough.
He's instrumental. We'll come to that. The last one we're going to do is Gavrilov.
Yeah, Pyotr Gavrilov. Now, he is out of the three... real dudes in this, you know, in this film, he is possibly the most famous. He is known as the hero of the defense of the Brest Fortress. Now he lived to a decent ripe old age. His ethnicity is Kryashin, okay, which they were baptized Tatars, mainly from Tatarstan. He is head of the 42nd Rifle Division and held out for 31 days at the Brest Fortress.
Yeah. He was the last person to surrender. Tragically, again, in real life, and this happened on such an enormous scale that, again, it kind of boggles the mind. Any Soviet soldier or sailor or airman that had been captured by the Germans, upon the ending of hostilities, Stalin created an order where anyone who had been a prisoner of war in a Western prisoner of war camp, or even had fought alongside, as happened at the defeat of Berlin, Americans and British soldiers and Canadian soldiers, were arrested and put into concentration camps. This famously happened to the brilliant Russian author and playwright Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whose only crime had been to successfully fight his way, which, by the way, is no small feat, across the whole of Europe to Berlin, and then promptly was arrested because he had been in contact with Western capitalist imperialists. And that was enough for Stalin. So people like Gavrilov, who later in the 50s was made a hero of the Soviet Union, actually went straight to jail after the war.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
It's not as bad what happened to Kizhavatov, though, I've got to say.
What happened to Kizhavatov?
Well, Kizhavatov... it's what happens to Kizhavatov's family. So
yeah, that's the thing.
So he is killed.
Defending his section of the fortress.
Yeah, the border guards part. But once the German army move into... Barbarossa takes off completely. In a village, his entire family is then, who survived this.
Yeah, they escaped the press fortress.
They were all murdered. So wife, all his children, mother.
The lot.
The lot, absolutely. Wiped, I mean, that's the family was just wiped off the planet. I mean, it's just appalling.
One of the great tragedies of the Soviet Union and Russia, if you look at it throughout its history, post and pre-Soviet Union, is the incredible cost that fighting for the Soviet Union and or Russia makes on its population. Hitler really did intend to wipe out every living person east of Poland, and probably would have probably got rid of Poland as well if he had had the chance. He was intent on this, which is why when you see the final figures of not just military, but civilian casualties on the Eastern Front is over 25 million people.
Yeah.
Because the Germans didn't give a toss. They just murdered and executed everybody they came, every village they came to, they destroyed and raped and pillaged.
That's right.
So, and then the Soviets did the same going the other way.
Yeah. And Hitler gave an order, I'm paraphrasing, but during Barbarossa is that, any Slav, Jew, and this is civilians,
yeah,
that look sideways at us, must be shot,
Yeah. Basically, and even some that didn't look sideways.
And you imagine telling that to a group of young, brainwashed men who think they're doing the right thing and they're armed to the teeth.
Yeah,
I mean, they're going to have a field day, and that's what's so grotesque about it.
And tragically, the German propaganda machine, which had for a couple of years now been basically destroying the Slavs and creating this sense of German superiority, led to a sort of condition, I would imagine, among most of the German soldiers, not all of them, and there are many generals who, during the war, wrote privately of their disgust and their distaste.
There's also an awful lot who changed their mind.
Yeah, conveniently, at the end. None of them stopped it, though.
No, exactly.
Which is the important thing. And so that when you unleash that sort of military force who have been so indoctrinated. I truly believe that your average German soldier didn't look on the Slavs or the Soviets as being human beings.
Well, Slavs were, through propaganda and through, you know, the ideology that they were being, you know, brainwashed by, Slavs were a subhuman race.
Yeah, they're the Untermenschen.
And they were just in the way. That was it. Simple as that.
So that's our introduction to Operation Barbarossa and the introduction to the fortress, the Brest Fortress, which brings us right up to the film. So, dear listeners, oh, you're so lucky. You get a double episode. So we're going to take a little break here. Please, having listened to this, tune in to part two of the Foxhole Companions review and examination of the film The Fortress of War.